It's a great honor to be here in Cambridge, and it's a great privilege for me, and I'm deeply aware of it, on the one hand because I have an incredible sense of what your generation will be faced with in your adulthood. And on the other hand, all of you here as students now are in that period which Winston Churchill called the Big Seven, the years between 18 and 25, when so many of the fundamental decisions of your lives will be decided. And we're talking this week about one of the deepest of them all. Let me start with a story, though. Some years ago, I was giving a lecture series in London with E.F. Schumacher, who is a great economist and a celebrity because of his bestseller in the 60s, Small is Beautiful. And he described how he'd just come back from Leningrad, St. Petersburg now, and he'd gone from his hotel, following the map extremely carefully, but found himself in front of some great Russian Orthodox churches with their golden domes, and they weren't on the map. And he was sure he had not made a mistake. And seeing him puzzled, the Soviet guide came up to him, and she said, "Can I help you?" And he said, "I'm sure I haven't made a mistake. Why aren't these on the map?" "Oh, that's easy," she said. "In the Soviet Union, we don't mark churches on the map." "Oh, yes, you do," Schumacher said. "Here's one." "Oh, no, no, no," she said. "That's a museum. We don't mark. We mark dead churches, not live churches." And Schumacher began his lecture series like that, and he said, as a European intellectual who took his faith seriously, he realized that in many of the universities of the Western world, what he knew well as reality was not on the maps of knowledge. And sadly, that's true of many of our universities, certainly true of Oxford, maybe not of Cambridge. Socrates says, the unexamined life is not worth living. That's probably the most quoted saying in classical writings outside the Bible. And yet the sad thing today is it's rarely followed. And there are many books showing how our Western education no longer deals with the good life or the meaning of life, but it's about credentials and careerism and anything but what it is that makes a good and profound human life. Now, in these lunch bars, I want to try and do two things. First, take up every day a specific issue. Today, why the unexamined life is not worth living. But also to tie in the specific issues with an overall sense of the journey of a thinking person towards that quest for meaning. So today I want to pick up what is really the first stage in a journey of a thinking person's quest for meaning, which is a time for questions. People start to think and care when, for whatever reason, might be curiosity, it might be puzzlement, it might be a deep emotional or practical crisis, life suddenly becomes a question mark, and they begin to search for an answer. In the last century, one of your most famous Cambridge graduates was the journalist Malcolm Muggeridge. He actually described his 4 years at Cambridge as the most futile and dismal years of his whole life. But it gave him a settled conviction that reason and rationality would give him no answers. He then went to the Soviet Union, and he was one of the first to see through Stalin and came back from that with a settled conviction that politics had no answers either. Then he went to India for 3 years and came back from that experience convinced that neither Hinduism nor religion in general had any answers. And World War II saw him in the Secret Service, but posted to what he thought was irrelevant, monitoring German shipping off the coast of Mozambique. And one day, overwhelmed with the meaninglessness of it all, he decided to take his life and swim out in the ocean and end it. And he swam out, leaving his clothes on the shore. And just as he was about to sink, he turned round and saw the lights of the little town that he'd left. And suddenly to him, they seemed like the lights of home. And he swam back and he said, I got on the shore and became a seeker for the answer to that sense of home which had stopped him committing suicide. All his biographers say, Muggeridge disbelieved before he believed. Now, Freud and many Freudians go wrong there. They say all belief is a matter of projection, wish fulfillment, and so on. People have needs and they believe. No, no, he got the logic wrong. When people become seekers, it's not that they believe. No, they're seeking. But the logic is they disbelieve what they used to believe because it no longer answers the questions that they now have. Now, in the social sciences, we say that every human being needs a sense of meaning and belonging. We need to make sense of our world. We need to find security in life. And that's the way we make the most of it, if we can. Steiner, the great Jewish critic, George Steiner, he says, we're not so much Homo sapiens, we're Homo quarens, the animal that asks and asks and asks. Isaiah Berlin said, philosophers are just adults who've gone on asking the questions that children asked and haven't stopped. Albert Camus opens his famous book, The Myth of Sisyphus, arguing that suicide is the fundamental philosophical question. Why? If at that point of despair, you really have to think why you have a reason to live, and if you have a reason not to die, then you truly have a reason to live. Camus said later, to give up my life is a little thing, and I would have the courage to do it if necessary. This is in terms of the French resistance against the Nazis. But, he said, to see the meaning of life dissipated and our reason for existence vanishing, that is what is unbearable. One cannot live without meaning. Now, if you think, why? It is your meaning of life that will give you the understanding of what's reality. It's your meaning of life that will give you the understanding of your own identity and who you are. It's the meaning of life that will give you the understanding of your moral choices and the rights and wrongs and the ethics of your world. And it's your sense of meaning which will give you a deep sense of belonging and the community in which you find your fundamental home in this universe. And without some of these deep things, life will be impoverished in one way or the other. Now, of course, the obvious question rises, if it's that important, why don't more people think all the time? The fact is they don't. Two great answers have been given to that, and see if these fit people that you know around you. One answer is Blaise Pascal's, the great French scientist. He says, almost preceding T.S. Eliot, who said humankind cannot bear much reality, Pascal says we don't want to think about our death. As the Bhagavad Gita puts it, the Hindu scriptures, the wonder of all wonders is that we humans are surrounded with death, but we don't actually think that we will die. But Pascal called that diversion. The way humans surround themselves with a busy, entertaining distraction to stop themselves thinking seriously about the meaning of life, thinking enough, caring enough. So busy, distracted, entertaining, they don't bother. The unexamined life is not worth living, but they live unexamined lives. And today, of course, with modern technology and all the things we can do, we can be more distracted than ever. You can be right next to your best friend and tweeting them rather than talking to them eye to eye and face to face. and our generation is one of the most diverted generations in all human history. The other reason given for why people don't think is what's called, in one word, bargaining. Later we say, you know, when I've graduated, when I got my job, or my mortgage is paid, and my kids are starting to grow up, or I've whatever, and then when I've retired and have time to think, it's always later, 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 later. But of course, we run out of laters. And bargaining doesn't work, and that's where the Faust figure comes in our Western literature. The man who wants more knowledge and more experience or whatever, and so he bargains with his own soul with the devil. But of course, if you know the Faust stories, the devil has read the small print. Faust didn't, and eventually there are no more laters. But there are many people who are simply not thinking. But that leads in turn to the question, why do people think? What in real life are the experiences which trigger people really thinking and searching in the way I'm talking about? Many obvious reasons. For some people, it's the seasons and passages of life. As I said, the big 7 years are when many people think it through in the deepest way, but people who don't go on, and then maybe a midlife crisis, maybe a health scare, or whatever. Another reason why people think are the grand historical crises. When I was a student, there were still many passionate Marxists. Many of the earlier Marxists were disillusioned in the 30s with the news of the terror famines in Ukraine. And then in the 50s with the first reports of the gulags. But then, of course, the grand falsification of Marxism with the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1989. And thousands all over the Western world gave it up. As Arthur Koestler had written earlier, the God that failed. It was falsified historically. But I've always been interested in the way that people start searching because of experiences in their own personal lives. My mentor in the social sciences, Peter Berger, calls this signals of transcendence. Experiences that people have that bleep like a signal and point beyond the adequacy of the worldview they have to this point, and they become searchers and seekers and look for meaning that they know they don't have to this point. I don't know if you know the name G.K. Chesterton. Great journalist, again, in the last century. But he went to the Slade College of Art in the 1890s, which was very like our sort of postmodern climate. Bitter, cynical, somewhat pessimistic. And Chesterton said as an 18-year-old, he flirted with that, and he was tempted to go towards a very dark view of life. But Chesterton said, as he thought about life, and I'm quoting him now, I was stopped in my tracks by a dandelion. Say, what? Not a glorious sunset, not a Mozart sonata, by a dandelion. His philosophy, of his teachers and others, was very cynical and pessimistic. But he said there was something about life that had a wonder to it that I couldn't deny. And I had to explain why life could be dark and why it still had this wonder and was so bright. And he became a seeker. Or take another one. W.H. Auden, great English poet in the last century. He was a left-wing atheist. He fought in the Spanish Civil War on the Republican side against Franco. But when the war clouds loomed, he went to America. And he settled in Manhattan in what was then Yorkville, which was largely a German-speaking part of Manhattan, which he didn't realize. No television. So he'd go every day, or every weekend, to see the news in the local cinema with a documentary. And one Saturday, the news was the siege of Poland. And Nazi stormtroopers were bayoneting women and children. And the German-speaking crowd, to be fair to them, it was early in the war, they didn't know the death camps or anything like that. The German-speaking crowd, obviously on the side of Germany, cried out, "Kill them! Kill them!" egging on the stormtroopers. And Auden sat there in the darkness. He said, in 2 minutes, my whole worldview was overturned. He said, I'd always thought humans were good. Better education, improved politics, little psychology, and the problems would be solved. I looked at that and I said, we, and he included himself, we have evil in our hearts. But then he said, I was in trouble. I had to say that Hitler and the SS were absolutely evil. But I spent all my life, he said, as a European intellectual, saying there's no such thing as absolutes. Everything's relative. Your class, your gender, your race, or whatever. Everything's relative. Nothing's absolute. But that was absolutely evil. He said, I left the cinema a seeker after an unconditional absolute. You can give many stories of people whose experiences, signals of transcendence, were triggers that set them off to think. Now, some squelched that. You may know the name Kenneth Clark, the National Gallery director and the great art historian and the man who produced the magnificent series for the BBC, Civilization. He describes, as a young art historian, being in Florence. And in the beauty of what he was studying, he was overwhelmed. And he said, I felt the finger of God. But he said, what would I do if I went back to London with my fellow intellectuals who'd scorned me? What would I do, because my own life, he said, was morally compromised, and he had a good number of affairs. And so he said, I just pushed it on one side and thought no more about it. Although, in fact, that wasn't the end of the story. But you see where I'm challenging you to think today. A lot of people would like me to move straight to the destination. No. I'd prefer to start slowly and say to every single one of you here today, do you think enough? Do you care enough to be sure that you are setting about living an examined life? That's the challenge today. I'm not demonstrating anything over these lunch bars. In essence, I'm inviting you to something, to examine what's a way of life. Those who believe in Jesus are not faith heads, as Richard Dawkins says. On the contrary, we would argue for an examined life and a fully warranted belief. But more of that as we go on. Today, the challenge is simply, don't be there bargaining. But one day you'll think of these things. Don't be there diverting yourself and at this great university, but without getting down to the things that really, really matter. Are you leading an examined life? Are you at least caring and thinking enough to be a seeker after the truth and a way which will be adequate for you all? Now you'll see that tomorrow will go on much more specifically. If the first step in a thinker's journey towards the quest for meaning is a time for questions, the second step is a time for answers, and we'll go on much more specifically. But let me leave it there today.